So I just want to drink in the beauty in this room. And I want to invite you to drink it in. Just look around the room. Just notice the pause that we're in. A community celebration. And this is the community that we're celebrating. Thank you for coming. My name is Betty Burks. I am so happy to be here. I am so grateful to be engaged in what we are about to do, to celebrate this history, 30 years of practice, of refuge, of Dharma, of guiding teachers, of the beauty of this facility that's here every day for us. What goodness and good fortune we have. And how blessed we are to be here today to celebrate it. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. So I want to tell you a little bit about the day that we're going to have, that we're going to share. I have a program here in front of me, an agenda. Before I do that, in this pause to celebrate, I'd like us to just reflect a moment on what's made it possible for us to be here. Who are the people in our lives that have contributed to us being here today? Just bring them into the room with us. Make it very crowded. And two of them are sitting with us this afternoon. Thank you. So I'm welcoming, and after I'm finished, which is going to be very soon, Narayan is going to say a few words. Then Larry is going to say a few words. And then Lynn is going to say a few words. And then we're going to hear a little bit about the rest of the day from Lynn, what else is happening in the building this afternoon. And then we're going to have a community conversation. You're going to get to talk back to the words that you have heard. And this year is really, this celebration, this year of 30th anniversary, is really a year that we're wanting to engage the community in conversation, not only about the reflections of the past and the goodness of today, but also what we are envisioning for the next 30 years. So we want to all be in that together, in the open, loving conversation. Thank you. Thank you again for coming, and welcome to all of us in the room and all of those that we brought into the room to be with us, who made it possible for us to be here today.
Hey. Larry and I saw each other just before we came upstairs in the teacher's room, and we realized that we're in a little bit of an altered state today, because it's surprising to be here 30 years later. I want to begin with a story. When Larry and I went to practice with Ajahn Mahabua in northeast Thailand, just after the center opened in 1985, so maybe we went in the fall of that year. And while we were there, we had a very good practice experience, and we connected very strongly with the community of monks. And it was a great trip. From a practice point of view, it was really a wonderful, wonderful trip. And when we left, just before we were about to come back, we had our last interchange, our last meeting, with one of the teachers that was there, John Panya, whom we had a very close connection with. And he said to us, and other people were echoing this as well as we were leaving, it's so unfortunate that you have to go. You know, you are in the best practice situation possible in the forest and in an ordained community, and it's so quiet here. I mean, I had to object to that because there were these wild chickens that were truly, truly making more noise than in a city. But I guess, you know, those would be called natural sounds, and if you're in a forest, you might not call human voices natural sounds. I don't know. But anyway, because it was the kind of experience it was, and because we felt so intimate and so close to people, I had a moment, and I thought, maybe you're right. You know, maybe you're right. Not maybe we can stay, because that really wasn't where it was at. But maybe it's true. Maybe we have to practice in Thailand. And, you know, it's absurd to think that you can practice in the midst of a city. And so I just filed that away and came home, and we got home in the middle of the night. It was really dark. I walked into the building, and the hall at that time was on the first floor, as some of you remember. We had to shush everybody because the meditation hall was on the first floor. So much better that it's up here so that we can talk in other parts of the building. But I remember coming back and opening the door of the meditation hall and it hitting me, the silence hitting me, the stillness hitting me, the loving kindness present in this building hitting me over the head. It was actually a physical experience. And I thought, oh, you know, how did I get caught in that little delusion that there's one good place to practice and it's not here? And I realized that, you know, this was in the very beginning of our being here, that this is a great practice situation for us all. I want to mention, some of you know this and some of you don't, but the green cushions that we have here, the reason for the green cushions is because of the Thai forest tradition. So, you know, they could be any color, but the reason that they're green was to bring a little bit of, I don't know, nature in. So we are doing our best. When the building was bought, and just before I left, I wrote a quick email to our beloved benefactor who bought the building 30 years ago with great gratitude. But when the building was bought, we found out a little bit about the history of this place. And the history is really fantastic. The history, from what we were able to find out, is that before we owned it, way before we owned it, it began, I guess, as a birthing center. So many babies were born in this building. And then the story is that after it was a doctor and his nurse, and then the doctor died, and then his nurse took over and opened it as a homeless center, a center for the homeless. So I would just say that compassion is built into the very bones of the building. You know, we came in with a beautiful history already having happened, and we're building upon this history. Not just these 30 years, but way before then as well. When we moved in, a neighbor next door, I guess, called one of the politicians in Cambridge and complained, you know, is it a cult? Do I have to, you know, put up with this meditation center next to me? I don't even know what Buddhism is, and it sounds weird. And I bumped into this politician years later, and he said that the person who had called him, he had bumped into 10 years after that, and this person said they were sitting at the center. So if it was you, I invite you to identify yourself, because I have no idea who this anonymous person was, but I love this story. I love this story. So I want to thank everyone who's been a part of this over the last 30 years, particularly thanking our long lineage of EDs, of executive directors, beginning with Jean Ann Whittington, who started us off in such a beautiful and grounded way. She had been a manager, which is the same thing as an executive director at IMS. So she put really good systems into place right away. She also contacted me this morning saying she wished that she could be here. You know, we never lose anybody. We're just in this together. And after Jean Ann, there was Sandra, Lucy, Bob, Colette, who was here for quite a significant amount of time, Madeline, who was here for 14 years, and now our Lynn, who is our executive director now, and we're very grateful. I want to appreciate the staff over the years. It's been tremendous, the staff that we've had, and particularly right now, I don't see Aaliyah. Yeah, Aaliyah and Claire. And just so much gratitude for the countless acts of kindness and generosity. It's a true joy to have both of you in the office. And I was having a really, you know, a silent smile when you gave up your seat to Nancy just now. So. And I very much want to appreciate our hard-working boards over these last 30 years. We've had many boards, and all of our boards have held us in the ways that we have needed to be held. And right now, the board that we have, just immense gratitude to. You'll meet everybody by the end, actually, this mysterious board. You will actually be introduced to at the end. So I also want to say a few words, acknowledge those who are absent, who are missing. And I first want to talk about Madeline, who has been such a vital part of the center. She unfortunately is not able to be here today because she is teaching at IMS. So she asked me to give her just warmest regards to everyone, and she'll be back on Tuesday. And of course, I can't not mention our beloved Jerry Bass, because, you know, he was here for so long and he was so dear and he touched our hearts, and we remember him right now today. And of course, I very much want to acknowledge the absence, the retirement of Michael. Most of you in the room probably have not known the center without Michael having been part of it, and perhaps have only known the three guiding teachers throughout your lifetime at the center. So it really is such a big change, of course. I want to just say that if there are feelings or emotions having to do with the loss, with the change, that it's really appropriate to speak with Madeline, who is always available. Well, I shouldn't promise that she's always available. Anyway, she's pretty available. With Lynn and with the board, whom you'll meet. So please to really feel free to normalize the emotions or the feelings that you might be experiencing, which of course is lawful. I also want to say that, you know, we've had a long run of things being one particular way, and that's a little bit unusual in an organization, you know? And sometimes when it's like that, you can have the illusion of permanence, that everything is going to change, that my personal life is going to change, that, you know, everything in my life is going to change, but everything at the center is got to stay the way it's always been, right? And of course, everything, the rumors are true that everything is changing, everything is impermanent. So I wanted to just say a few words about kind of what we see ongoing. And I want to say that Larry and I are on it so you should feel reassured by that, that we aren't looking for a third guiding teacher to replace Michael. It will be the two of us until we collapse. And there is full scheduling. I want to make sure you know this, that even though on the web it looks like we're only scheduled till the end of May and then oh no, actually, we have a full schedule planned, Larry and I, visiting teachers, local teachers, until the very end of 2015. So this is how we're looking at going forward, is the guiding teachers and a body of local teachers, plus some visiting teachers as we move forward. And I guess I would also say, just ask for your patience around this whole thing. As I say, we're on it. You know, but patience and giving us a little space is also would be appreciated. So I want to read you something by Jean Vanier, who is as close to a Christian mystic as you can get. My memory is that Larry and I met him in Hob and Olivia's house. Maybe 35 years ago, but I have to say, you know, sometimes you imagine these things, so I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, my memory is that he was quite a wonderful person. So I want to read something called Community and Growth. In these times when towns are depersonalized and depersonalizing, many people are looking for community, especially when they feel alone, tired, weak, and unhappy. Some people find it impossible to be alone. For them, this is a foretaste of death. So community can appear to be a marvelously welcoming and sharing place. But in another way, community is a terrible place. It is the place where our limitations and our egoism are revealed to us. We discover our poverty and our weaknesses, our inability to get on with people, our mental and emotional blocks, our affective or sexual disturbances, our seemingly insatiable desires, our frustrations and jealousies, our hatred and our wish to destroy. While we were alone, we could believe we loved everyone. Now that we are with others, we realize how incapable we are of loving, how much we deny life to others. And if we become incapable of loving, what is left? There is nothing but despair and anguish. Love seems an ill illusion. We seem to be condemned to solitude and death. So community life brings a painful revelation of our limitations and weaknesses. The unexpected discovery of the monsters within us is hard to accept. The immediate reaction is to try to destroy the monsters or to hide them away again, pretending that they don't exist, or to flee from community life and relationships with others, or to find that the monsters are theirs, not ours. But if we accept that the monsters are there, we can let them out and learn to tame them. That is growth toward liberation. If we are accepted with our limitations as well as our abilities, community gradually becomes a place of liberation. Discovering that we are accepted and loved by others, we are better able to accept and love ourselves without fear or constraint. Community life deepens through mutual trust among all its members. So this terrible place can become one of life and growth. There is nothing more beautiful than a community where people are beginning really to love and trust each other. In community life, we discover our own deepest wound and learn to accept it. So our rebirth can begin. And it is from this very wound that we are born. I want to end on a personal note to say that there are times in life when you think you've made a choice and then you get to make that choice again. Maybe 10 years after the center opened, conditions came together in such a way that I felt that I needed to commit to this place, to this community, and so I did. And then over these last couple of years, with everything being turned upside down, the question arose for me again. Instead of it being just an assumption, there was really an alive questioning occurring. And I want to say to you that I am not here because of obligation. And I'm not here because of feeling overly responsible. I do know that the center would be beautiful without my presence. And I'm not here because of need. I am definitely here because of love. I am definitely here because of love. This is my community. Now, I go all over the world and teach in other places, and wherever I am, I love whom I'm with, of course. But it's different here. It's just different here. There's something profound and something that touches me over and over again. So I will always be home, and I will keep coming home. Thank you.
It's a tough act to follow. Let's party. This morning, it suddenly hit me that this place has been here for 30 years. I really have had other things on my mind. I mean, I knew we were celebrating 30 years and so forth, but it really hit me, and a few people, questions were forwarded to me, and some were directly asked, how did you wind up here, going from wherever you were? And I realized, I don't know. I could give a very sophisticated psychological answer, even including relationships with parents and all that, but it's not too convincing, at least it wasn't to me. How did I wind up going from, at 20 years old, I mean, I think part of it is that I'm a very slow learner. This might be encouraging for some of you who think that meditation is difficult. At 20, I was in the military in the occupation of Germany for 2 years, right after World War II. From there, after 2 years, I wound up in law school, which wasn't for me. From there, I wound up getting a PhD, which was a lot better. Wound up being a professor for 10 years. Great. But at a certain point, and then people have asked, why did you leave the university? I didn't. It left me. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, one day, whatever was so exciting for me, it wasn't anymore. It just sort of faded out on me, which is not to say universities aren't great places. They are. And so I felt a certain, altered state is the right word for it. The other thing I faced is I was given a 15-minute limit. Now, these days, there's a growing number of diagnostic initials. You know, everything is getting initials. And I have bodily imperfections and problems, but no initials. So I made up a diagnostic category for myself, which is BMD, blabbermouth disease. Now, it isn't medically affirmed yet. But it's going to be 15 minutes, kind of. I don't know. I don't know. So I haven't started yet. So this, what I said, 15 minutes from now. Yeah, okay. When Orion mentioned this building is impermanent, a lot of it is permanent. The frame, et cetera, a lot of improvements and alterations, but all of you, I lived here for 11 years. My wife is here. Raise your hand. That's how I get back at her for making me take the garbage out all the time. Okay. This was our kitchen. So you're in our kitchen. I hope you know that. Each one of you, I can see with the old. So, is that a lesson in impermanence? Yes. While it was here, it seemed awfully real and it was great because I had wandered for years before that It was very, very comforting to have a place to come back to, but not so great to live exactly where you teach. At any rate, 11 years were exactly where we are, and now it's this way. And I start to think, well, what is it I could point to that really was with us right from the beginning? And I don't know, some of you, you may not be able to see it. I may have to describe it for you. It's this altar. The sword bearer represents wisdom, the cutting through ignorance and so forth. The female figure holding the flower is compassion. And in between all these are clouds, which represent impermanence. And so I thought of how can I pack so much of what I feel I have to say in 15 minutes. So I thought, well, these days people use pointers and, you know, what do you call slide projectors. I'm very low tech. So I decided these three, the two figures and the clouds, those are the visuals, but I didn't know we would obscure them, sorry. This was a tree, a dead tree in Providence, Rhode Island. I spent 5 years in Korean Zen, and I was in Korea for 1 year at a monastery there. And I briefly met a monk who was a famous carver of for temples and monasteries. He would carve the things like this, like whatever wooden things. And he was very famous in Korea. He happened to be in Providence, Rhode Island. And so one thing led to another, and he agreed that he wouldn't do it they would not cut a tree down. That's their tradition. That's a good one. So this was a dead tree, and out of it he made the platform that you usually see, and he also made this. And he made it a retreat. During that time, he went into solitude, and it's interesting. They equate somehow spiritual with vegetarianism. So he refused to eat meat, fish, or chicken during that time, just vegetables. Okay, I don't think it makes a person necessarily more holy. I should know because I've been a vegetarian for 50 years. I'm not that holy, you know. Okay, and he did this, and okay. So how can I confine a lot of information? First of all, I found out that the newsletter, I tried to set the stage for us to understand how this place got started. But I was told that only about 25 or 30% of you read the newsletter. So very briefly, the first Dharma talk that was given here, I gave, and it wasn't here, it was downstairs. And I used the Visuddhimagga, which is an ancient Buddhist commentary on the Buddhist teaching, and listed all the places not to have a monastery or a meditation center. And we qualified on all of them. In other words, this was totally the wrong place, whereas traffic, lots of intersection where people are coming, a lot of commerce, political intensity, it went on and on. Not to mention now cars and sirens and ambulances and police cars and Mack trucks and all that. So this is a terrible place to start a center based on what this ancient text said. But we started it here. And, well, why? Very briefly, my conclusion, you have this building, is that at the time, now some of you may take this for granted, you may assume it's natural, but at the time it wasn't. Lay people, for the most part, at least in the countries that I practice at, mainly serve the monks and sometimes the nuns as well. But they're not expected to put energy into real practice. And this the situation in the modern world has changed, perhaps due to leisure or whatever. And there are more of us who do really want to practice. And so we needed a situation that was up to date because we weren't going to live out our days at IMS or at Forest Refuge, et cetera, Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, the Newburyport Center. It just wasn't going to happen. And so I also saw, having done lots of silent retreats, magnificent, wonderful. They're tremendously helpful. And do they fix everything? I haven't seen it. If they do, now they might, if you're just going to spend the rest of your life in that kind of a setting, because there's certain challenges you don't face, like what the quote referred to. Relationship is the big one. Work, family, school, you know, do I have to spell it out? So in other words, people run away from the city. One of the reasons you become a monk is to get away from all this, to not have to earn a living, to not have to have one meal a day, to not have any sex, to not. So I started to see that the teachings had very much of a monastic coloration to it, which is fine if you're living a monastic life, but we weren't. And so the building was the beginnings of an attempt to craft a practice that was relevant for us. So relevant in these times, in this place, and putting it here, even though it didn't, it was with all this noise and all the rest of it, was relevant precisely because this is where we live. So it's we all have access to it. And we're fortunate in that we have centers nearby where we can go in the country, more bucolic retreat with birds rather than ambulances. And that's wonderful too. It's not one versus the other. And so daily life became our challenge and relationship. And there's a simple Dharma teaching which has been very helpful for me. Not that I'm always able to do it, to put it mildly. A bad situation is a good situation. In other words, relationship seems to be the most difficult thing for us humans. We are brilliant in terms of technology, science, it's staggering. And yet, we still have not learned to live with each other. I'm going to save that for a few moments. Now, to get back to the gentleman with the sword and the other way around, and the female figure with a flower. And in the background are the clouds. The clouds represent what's a fundamental principle of the Buddha's teaching, that everything that arises passes away. Everything is impermanent. But it's not just that it's impermanent. It's impermanent in an unpredictable way. It's uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know when or how. And whether we like it or not, I look around, you must, if there's anyone who disagrees, we'll call the psychiatric award. it seems to be true of our situation. So if that's so, then are we helpless? What is called for, let's say, wisdom, the sword, and compassion really can't be separated. Wisdom, a high form of intelligence. What is wisdom? We call you yogis here. Do you ever stop to think of what that, why one of the meanings of it is not that you can do physical kinds of things and stretch and put your left toe behind your right ear or anything like that. If you can, good, you know, but a central meaning of yoga is skill in action. And skill in actual, what is skill? In the Buddhist use of the term, skill is wisdom. It's learning the art of living. And the skill is to unlearn what is unskillful, which means what's harmful to yourself and to others, and to cultivate, develop, and allow to flower what is beneficial for you and for others. So these are the tools that we have. In other words, we're not helpless. And we're here. And our life, like it or not, it seems like all or most of us are not going to be monks or nuns. And so this is our situation. We have to learn how to live with it. We have to learn how to not just put up with it or cope with it. Those terms are often used. And there's a split, even within the Dharma world, everyone would agree with what I just said, that daily life is the practice. It can become the biggest cliche in spiritual life because it's difficult. It's very difficult. And here, we've taken it on, and in 30 years, have we learned anything? A little bit. We're trying. We're committed to it. I think we've improved over when we started. We're starting to learn about some of the ways to help us all, because we're lay people too, help us all live in this world in a way that is minimally harmful to ourselves and to others. And it's not easy, because something keeps coming up. as Churchill put it when he was asked, what's your philosophy of history? Just one damn thing after another. Can't beat that. So the challenge is how to, the teachings, the essence of wisdom and compassion in the Buddhist teaching are timeless. If it was only something that was relevant 2,000, almost pushing towards 3,000 years ago, in ancient India, an agrarian society, etc., it wouldn't be that relevant for us. It would just be interesting, another interesting oriental way of behaving that is brought over here, and that is that we could study it and get a PhD in it. It isn't, because the Four Noble Truths starts with there is suffering. It seems like that continues to go on. Impermanence continues to go on. Now, what causes suffering? The content varies. But if you read the early teachings, it's very clear that even in that simple society, agrarian society, and they didn't have a lot of the things we have, they were suffering. People were cruel to each other. People betrayed one another. There were hurricanes. There were animals would kill. You know, it's just they had their own form of suffering. And so now we do. Now, so what does that, what about that? So that's the part that's traditional, in other words, that we have to conserve, because that teaching is timeless. And yet the challenge changes. So there's a radical thing, and that's each culture is different. If you read the history of Buddha Dharma, it has gone through many changes as it has moved from one culture to another. Sometimes it's almost unrecognizable. So you might say there are many Buddhisms. But the Four Noble Truths is part of all of them because it's human. So that if you're not a Buddhist, don't want to be a Buddhist, you're an atheist, you're a devout Jewish, Christian, Muslim, that's not relevant. I mean, what we do here, what we're teaching is, if you're suffering, if you know what that is, and you're willing to take a look at it, come on in. I mean, if you want to improve the quality of your life, if you care about the quality of your life, come on in. So other than that, that prerequisite doesn't exist. If you have fall in love with Buddha Dharma, which is quite a beautiful approach, a guide to living, great. If you don't, you're not handicapped, because the essence of what we're doing is human. We're learning how to take a look at our lives as we live it out, relationship being the biggest challenge of all, and how to use relationship so that we take that which is most difficult and turn it into something that helps us to flower. That's our big challenge. Okie dokie.
We know each other well.
Yeah. Okay. Some years ago, I spent a number of years with Thich Nhat Hanh and learned a lot from that great man. And one time he was very sad, and I was in a room with him. He was very sad, and we started to talk. And he described the plight of the boat people. At the time, people were trying to escape from Vietnam, and they mostly didn't get good ships, very rickety ships. And what he said was that he has learned that many of the ships never made it. They never got out of there. They'd come into the high seas and they just got lost at sea. And he said what they discovered, if there was one person who could remain calm and steady, stable, then the ship had a much better chance of surviving. A much better chance of surviving. If there was no one like that, because things are collective. For example, one of the powers of a sangha is the collective energy. Now, if you count on the community totally doing the job, that won't work. But is the community an incredible resource? Yes, there's collective energy. You can feel it. The silence is energy and being together. But then inevitably, we go back out and we face our world as it is. So what does that lead to? And I think I can tie it up. So Thich Nhat Hanh is saying if there's one person who can do it. Now, there's also, That means, who is that one person? Well, what we're attempting to do here, it's each of us. You are that one person. Now, what do you mean one person? You each have a world. Some of you may have a large family. Maybe some of you live alone. Some of you, everyone's situation is somewhat different. But you're in a world, and if to some degree what you learn here can help you improve, stabilize the quality of your life so that you don't get completely overrun by hardship when it happens, or if it happens, by aging, by illness, by death, by what happens to the people you love, and so forth. It's a tremendous asset. So each one of us is that one person in the ship. And I'll finish. I'm back at Brooklyn. I started out in Brooklyn. I'm finishing up with Brooklyn. You never leave Brooklyn anyway. Is any of you from there? It's true, right? Yeah. My grandmother told me this one. My grandfather reinforced it over and over again. In Hasidic culture, before it got ossified into political rigidity, the Hasids were a mystical branch of Judaism, and before that, the teachers were all, it meant how learned you were. And the Hasids rebelled against that, and they made it not just in the hands of the rabbis. They took it out of the rabbis, and they said, it's not what you know, it's who you are that counts. So, and then they had one little teaching, which was always given to me. I didn't get it until I was much older, which is, God gives each one of us a little part of the world to take care of. It's our job. And my grandmother used this example. It could be a push cart. It could be a corner grocery store. It could be a doctor's office. Whatever your little part of the world is, take care of it. So, get it? Okay, now, CIMC, what we want to do is, because we face a world, we're learning how to face a world in crisis. Because although there's always been dukkha, suffering, there's always been impermanence, something has happened. The scale has happened now. The danger of annihilation of the planet, of the environment is being destroyed. We've lost touch with nature. It goes, I don't have to spell this out. Which means that now we've unleashed such power that we have the capability of destroying the very beautiful planet that we live in. Now, if you see the Buddha's teaching, greed, hatred, and delusion is the centerpiece. You've heard of it, the three poisons. Now, if you look at what's going on in the world, the crisis isn't about nuclear weapons. It isn't about terrorism. Finally, if you go back further enough, it's a crisis in consciousness. It's that the human mind somehow don't get it, and we're living in a way that has not worked, it doesn't work, and there's always the question, can it be reversed? Can there be some sanity introduced on a larger scale? I honestly don't know. And I don't mean this as a messianic statement. If you all practice mindfulness and come to CIMC, everyone will be saved. That'd be nice. It's okay with me. But I don't mean that. What I mean is we have the opportunity to work on our small contribution, because this confused world is what we grew up in. So we got conditioned by it. But then also we have added to it. What are we adding to it? Are we contributing to exactly what we don't want to be here without realizing it on a smaller level? So our challenge is to be that one person in the rickety boat, is to take care of whatever that little piece of life God has given you to care for. And I think that's enough. You know. I'm usually the funny guy. What happened today? This one's activated, right?
Hi. That works. So now two acts to follow. Unfortunate me. No. I'm Lynn Whittemore. I'm the executive director here. I know quite a few people here, but certainly not everybody. So I'm delighted you're here and really delighted that we're launching our 30th anniversary with this event, a community gathering. There is a lot in store for the year that's about the 30th, and looking way ahead, in December we'll wrap up with another community conversation, so we'll learn more about what's ahead soon. But first I wanted to talk about a few things that have been on my mind. You know, I know our practice is all about being in the present moment, but I spend a lot of time thinking about the future. Sorry. Specifically, a lot about the future of CIMC in the next 30 years. It really matters to me that this place is here 30 years from now. It's something that I'm passionate about. It's really why I'm here, and it's not something I can do alone. So all of you gathered here, I'm going to invite you to join me in making sure this place is here 30 years from now. I came here for the first time 20 years ago, and I walked in and I sat. And part of wanting this place to be here 30 years from now is that I want anyone, no matter who they are, to be able to have that same experience of walking in the door 30 years from now and sitting. And my feeling at the time was, this place is just magic. It just exists. It's here. I walk in. There's a hall. I can sit. And since I've taken this job, I've learned a lot more about what has made that magic possible. It didn't just happen. It's kind of a nice thought, a blissful thought. It just happened, but it's not true. There have been a lot of people over the years who have supported in all kinds of ways, through service, through financial gifts, this center, and allowed it to be here today. We rest on the shoulders of many people, and Narayan mentioned one person in particular, one benefactor who gave this building to CIMC, and also who through the years, year after year after year, has made significant financial contribution that allows the center really to stay open. And we're in a time where things are shifting. This is kind of a turning point in the center in that we will not be able to rely on that all that much longer. And so it brings me to call sort of upon all of us to say, if that's true and we want the center to be here, how are we going to participate? How are we going to contribute and give? Again, there's so many different ways to do it so that the center is here all these years later. So I want to talk also a little bit about one of the things I've learned from Larry, which is how important it is to turn towards reality, focus on reality, let it in, live with it, accept it, work with it. Because it can be new to be talked, you know, for me, someone to stand up here and talk to you about money and talk to you about supporting the center and say, hey, we all need to be a part of this. But it's reality, and that's part of what I've learned from our teachers here. So. What I want to encourage everyone to do is to engage with the center, our own little part of the world, as Larry said, in new ways or in expanded ways, to the extent that each of us can. That might be through volunteering. There are a lot of people here who volunteer. Can volunteers here raise their hands? There's a whole lot of people in this room who are volunteers here. If you didn't raise your hand, we invite you to join us. It's a lot of fun. And it may be through contributing financially at a level you haven't before. It may be becoming a member for the first time if you haven't before. There are all kinds of ways. And I want to say every single gift and every act of generosity here, no matter the size, no matter the kind, is crucial. It's this community and all of these gifts that allow the center to be here today. There's nothing that is ever too small. So if your engagement is the lifeblood of the center, then I'm going to invite you to join us downstairs a little bit later. I'll tell you what's down there. There are all different kinds of ways, including some new ways like donables and other ways for you to sort of get engaged, to meet and greet, to see each other, to know that you're part of this community, and to take a look at what kind of options you might have to engage even more deeply. So here we are at 30. And I want to be here 30 years from now. I know you do too. So I'm looking forward to this year of celebration together. There are a lot of teachers who are coming to join us this year for talks and workshops from all over. They're donating their time because they want CIMC to thrive. They care about CIMC. CIMC is a very special place in the world. So we'll have John Kabat-Zinn, and we'll have Dan Siegel, Joanna Macy. We've got Joseph coming, a lot of different people who will be here. And I'm going to invite you to join us at those events and be part of those as well. So thank you again for being here. What we're going to do now is open up the floor to reflections or questions to Narayan or Larry, observations, things you might want to share about your hopes and aspirations for the place. I want to introduce Aaliyah again and Claire, who both work in the office with me, and they're going to take mics around. We want to make sure everyone can hear, so please use a mic when you speak. And so I guess we'll get started. Thank you.
Lynn, in terms of time, will you cut us off, or?
Yeah. Do you want me to?
We have until?
4:25.
Okay, 4:25.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so when we're done, we'll then take just a couple minutes to introduce you to a few people and then tell you what's waiting downstairs.
I think from a community point of view, if you could say your first name before you speak, that would be great.
Leonard.
You don't have to stand, but if you want to.
Ryan, you told us you'll always be here and you'll always come back, but after all, there are such things that all people are subject to.
Such as death.
Old age, sickness,
death. I'm very aware of that.
So since we are aware of it, maybe this is a question that would have better been directed to the board.
Maybe this would really be better for the board, but since this is the opportunity we have, I'm just wondering if there is an explicit procedure for succession of guiding teachers whenever it will become necessary. And so is there a way the board can act when it needs to?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a good question, and I think I can answer it, which is that we're in that very process right now. We're engaged as a board in the process of looking at all of these kinds of questions. And that's kind of what I meant by a little bit of patience. Not that your question isn't a really significant and important one, but this is going to take us some time to look at as a board and figure out.
Is there a procedure?
No, that's what I'm saying, is that we're looking at procedures, right? We're looking at what the procedures may be. Do you want to?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Do you mean a procedure on the other end, people seeking to teach? Is that what you mean?
That's another good question.
No, then forget. No, that one. No. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. The board does not appoint a guiding teacher. Narayan and I are the ones who are in charge of the. We have a division of labor. We all work together, consult with each other. But on matters of teaching, because we've been, our Dharma teaching and practice has been, this is what we do. So we have the final responsibility for that. There are two models, essentially. One is training models, which more and more is bringing up, which we don't. You train people, and then out of that comes teachers. It's more like, almost like licensing people if you put in and pass certain challenges and so forth. We don't work that way. I see it as more spontaneous, and so does Narayan. In other words, we wait until if there's a right person. I feel that you have to be born for this kind of work. It's, now, when we started, do you think I wanted to be a Dharma teacher? I mean, it's ridiculous. I have no idea. You know, I'd never heard of the term. Now people come up and say, how do you become a Dharma teacher? Is it, you know, they want to make it B.A., M.A., Ph.D. And that may happen in some places, but it's not, as at least between the two of us, we want it to be more spontaneous and allow, in a sense, life to provide the people that are right for this kind of work. But then we still have to consult with the board, so we work together, but the final choice would be ours, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I would also say that, you know, if both of us conk out at the same moment, then, of course, the board would have to take over. That's unlikely, you know, it's unlikely. And, you know, if, whatever, on my last breath, I could do something. But Anyway, we're I'm with Larry.
So the board does have the ability to do that if you were both disabled or not.
I'm sure. Yes. Yes.
My name is Kathy, and I think I got hired to be the director of the Peace Commission around the corner in 1987.
Yeah.
And in that process of trying to be a more peaceful human being, recovering human beingness, I went to an acupuncturist to say, how can I resolve the sense of feeling like there are flaws that are just hard to live with? And he said, you should go to meditation. And because I trusted him implicitly with my well-being, I said, all right. And then it turned out the center was around the corner from my office. And so I signed up for the first thing there was, which was an all-day training with Narayan, a beginner's workshop. 6 hours. I had never meditated in my life and thought, oh my goodness. And it's been a kind of unfolding, and I sort of understood meditation and Buddhism as being a practice of renunciation, and one of the first questions that was asked of Narayan at that moment was, does being a Buddhist in meditation mean you have to renounce sex? And Narayan said, that's not been my experience. And went on to say in that moment that the process of meditation is really to deeply, deeply see things as they are. And for many people, that can be a deepening and a more profound sense of intimacy. For some, it may lead you to make a different choice.
Yeah.
And since that, maybe it was 1988, I've been a beginner's drop-in person for 25 years, in addition to things, and kind of coming back and feeling the gratitude of it. I'm just kind of curious whether, in terms of your teaching and sense of Dharma and Dharma practice and sort of emphasis at the center, whether there have been changes and shifts and ways in which what you have emphasized has become different over time.
Right. That's a great question. Do you want to answer that first?
And it's a great question, and you give it to me. Yeah. I wish I could. Could I see you? Yeah. Good. No, I just. Yeah. Thanks. That's what I was getting at. Is that, for example, the monastic approach, at least in this tradition, one meal a day, and the meal is donated by other people, so you have no choice in terms of diet, right? No sex, items of clothing, etc. So now that to me is not necessarily holy. It's a convention. It's something that a strategy that can help a lot of people, but it's external. It's no guarantee that you're going to become freer because you only eat one meal a day. Just live at some of these monasteries. You'll see that some people use it beautifully, were born for that, and it helps them. And for many people, it's just an outer trapping. So that, but what we need to teach, for just take a few of the things you mentioned, nutrition. Why would we want to deprive us of now that it's becoming big? And it should. Nutrition is an important part of life. And does it have to be anti-spiritual? It's dangerous because people can become obsessed with diet and take their attention off getting liberation, let's say. But it needn't be that way. It just means they've related to diet improperly. Sex. Sex is neither spiritual nor non-spiritual. It's just what it is. Depends on how you use it. You can use it to destroy yourself, or it can be. So it's the same with all of these things. The real renunciation isn't how many, you can keep all your dresses and your high heels if you wear them or whatever it is. That's not going to make you less. If you throw everything out, what?
I guess there's a few people who know me here.
Okay. Let's say, So that's what I meant. There's a monastic, and some of the teachings have that coloration, which it took me a number of years to realize. Some of the monks who I studied with, I felt gave advice to people that was not appropriate. I could give examples, but I don't think I, you know, take too long. So that's part of our challenge. I don't think anything's changed. We're meeting from day one life as it is, which includes everything. There's nothing left out. Learning how to best do that, that's what I meant is our challenge. But in and of itself, it's not spiritual or not spiritual. Depends on what you do with it.
Yeah. You know. So I'll answer from a little bit of a different perspective, because it's such an interesting question. And I would say that we started CIMC with a particular vision, and that vision actually came out of practice. It wasn't like just, oh, this is a good idea, or, oh, you know, yogis need this, or anything like that. It was actually an insight. It was actually in kind of an understanding about practice that both of us had, and Michael shared as well, where there was a particular orientation that was very, very clear at a certain point in practice, and for all of us early on, this orientation happened. And then that orientation has been a guide ever since. So it's like, you know, you could do this, there's this fashion, there's Upandita comes into town and everybody does that for a while. There's, there's different fashions, believe it or not, in Dharma life. And I don't mean to say that in a belittling kind of way, but, you know, people get excited about different forms of practice at different times. And I would say that we have been truly steadfast in terms of what we see as important as essential because it came out of insight and wasn't just a good idea. And so that's where something has remained absolutely the same. I would have that same answer today. And at the same time, you know, one teaches what's alive for oneself. And so it's the same thing, but different emphasis at different times. So, you know, you're subjected to, I was on this thing for a while around, is this moment just as good as any other moment? Yeah, you guys remember. And, you know, harangue, harangue, nag, nag, you know, excitement, excitement. It's because it was very alive for me. And then it changed. There was a new arena of investigation. And of course, you know, you can't help but have what is happening in your own life have its effect on the teaching as well. I always see it as a deepening, and that we all deepen together. And that's actually what I've seen in this community over the last couple of years. My awareness is that there's been a deepening and a greater degree of maturity. So, yeah. Okay.
Nancy, is this on?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So my question actually grows a little bit out of the trajectory of my own practice, which I'll just say a quick word about, which is in the early 80s, I came back from graduate school quite uncertain about what I was going to do. And a friend of mine in graduate school had a sister here who was a therapist. And the therapist's name was Trudy Goodman, who I think a lot of people know here, who now runs LA Insight. Is that right? So anyway, I went to see this therapist, Trudy Goodman. And she said, well, you know what? I don't think you really need therapy. I think you should take a course with this friend of mine named Jon Kabat-Zinn. So that was back in the early 80s, and I did that. And then, you know, I was pretty scattered and unsettled, and it kind of took, but it kind of didn't. And so around 5 years later, I found my way to the center. And actually, in the interim, I trained in mindfulness-based stress reduction. So anyway, I came in the nervous door. That's how I got here. And so over the years, I've gotten more and more interested and familiar with the Buddha's teachings, and including here and going on a lot of retreats and stuff like that. And I feel like we're just incredibly blessed to have CIMC here, to have IMS nearby, and of the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, also nearby. So as somebody who's gotten more and more interested in reading the early teachings of the Buddha, it's been on my mind as we think toward the future of CIMC as to whether or not there might be an opportunity here for engaging in some sutta studies. And I know that's really, you know, the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies has really got that pretty well covered and has so many wonderful, wonderful courses. And they're constantly changing. But what about some kind of over time possibility of sutta studies of the early teachings of the Buddha here with some, you know, really wonderful guiding teacher?
So I would say possibly. I kind of would use this question as a question to move into vision a bit, which is that we are really aware that we don't want to or need to be all things to all people, and that we happen to be in Cambridge, where Barry Center for Buddhist Studies is an hour and a half away. You know, if we were in Kansas, it's a different story. And I keep picking on Kansas. I hear there's more Dharma in Kansas these days, too. But anyway, here we are. You know, we're in a hotbed of practice and study and everything in this particular, I don't know, karmically interesting area of the world, really. So what I would answer is to say possibly, you know, and that's the kind of suggestion that's helpful to us, because we'll take it under advisement.
This isn't quite what you've asked for, but in my own case, I couldn't agree with you more. But so often, if you get sutra study from someone who doesn't have much practice, which can be common, it's going to be different than someone who's done some study and also put the sutta into practice. So I don't know if they're still in store, all the talks that are given here. I was told that I've given over 1,000 talks. I spent about 30 talks on the Satipatthana Sutra, 40 talks on the Anapanasati Sutta, and countless other talks on different suttas. But that was just something I did, and some people got interested in it, and many didn't. And your idea is a good one, and we've, right from day one, contemplated that configuration as like a floating campus, that is IMS, Forest Refuge, et cetera, residential places where you could check in and stay for extended periods of time, and then to come back here. To answer a bit your question, the language, the insight I learned is that I started to see the limitations of thinking that you could just sit your way through every problem in life. I didn't see it work. For example, at IMS, for years, I did lots of three-month retreats in Korea and Japan and so forth, and they would end by saying, now we're going back into the real world. That's this world. And I heard it, and the yogis would talk about, now we're going into yogi land, the staff. They would. Now, to me, there's just one life, and there always has been. And these are like stage sets. This is useful. IMS is very useful. It's a form of life. This is a form. And your job, the insight that came out of it was a realization that, indeed, things have changed radically, that lay people really have energy and time and interest. And so we needed a practice which we're constantly trying to improve our ability to deliver that is relevant for the actual life that we live. Otherwise, we become second-class monks or nuns. We're neither lay people nor monks or nuns. Somewhere, some vague, I don't know what, species that doesn't know what it is. But it's a good idea. And we can't do everything, of course not. Yeah.
Given that we're talking some about vision, this is really just, you know, doesn't have to do with your question, but it's a takeoff on kind of a combination of Nancy's question and Catherine's question, which is just to say that Krishnamurti is really our patron saint. You know, those of you who are familiar with Krishnamurti, Larry and I probably bonded initially because of Krishnamurti. And what that means is that although I don't have an objection to calling myself a Buddhist, and I do. And I love Buddhism, and I love the Buddha, and I take refuge in the Buddha, and we have all these Buddhist statues, and, you know, et cetera,
and I don't.
Et cetera. At the same time, Krishnamurti is really, I mean, I would say it has, Krishnamurti had to do with this original understanding that I was speaking to before, you know, that what we're doing is beyond form and beyond tradition. And, you know, really we're trying to do what the Buddha said, which is to not adopt anything without investigating and experimenting and testing it out for yourself. And then doing it with your whole heart when you have some confidence in this.
My name's Eleanor, and I'm really grateful to Lynn for having brought up the sometimes taboo subject of material support or financial support, both for CIMC and for Dharma teachers. I think one of the things that has inspired me most in Western Buddhist teaching is the vision that a group of people brought back that we could have Dharma teaching in the West without a fee, that it would be given freely. And when I tell my friends that, you know, they shake their heads, and I think they shake their heads more now than they did 25 years ago, because that's not the way our American society works. And I'm very cognizant also of the transition of a religious organization from one which is based financially on the generosity of a few benefactors to one that really does not have big benefactors anymore with a lot of material resources, but more depends on smaller amounts of support from a much larger pool of people. And I just hope with all my heart that somehow we as a community can pull together and figure out how we can support this center, both the bricks and mortar and our Dharma teachers, so that this wonderful tradition can continue for 30 more years or 30 years beyond that, and really forever. And I just am so grateful that the center is here now.
I have faith that it will happen, and I'm usually not so much of a faith kind of guy. My first Vipassana teacher was a man named Munindraji from India, and he left me with a phrase that seemed awfully corny, but it's turned out to be, he said, if you take care of the Dharma will take care of you, but you can't take care of the Dharma in order for it to take care of you.
Yeah.
So if you want...
Amen.
In other words, if you want that to materialize, what your deep yearning is, for all of us, practice. Practice. Don't worry. The rest comes out of, it just seems to. And I know it sounds corny and mysterious and all that. It is in a certain way, but I'm sure it can be explained. So that's the best contribution we could make for the center to flower. So it's a real place.
And thank you so much.
I have the microphone because it was next to me. real quick, I'm probably one of the newest members here. I started in November coming to the center. And I just want to speak up. My name's Allison. And I just want to speak up for the concept of membership here. I'm unemployed, but I can scrap together $10 a month to be able to come to this center at my free will, to be able to access the library and all the teachings in the library. This library is a really wonderful resource. And to be able to come into the meditation hall and sit for however long. You can have a mini retreat here on some days by yourself or with a few other people. And it takes just whatever you can afford to be a member here, and you get so much. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, everybody. Well, great questions, and it's the beginning of a conversation that'll go on over the year. But we want to wrap up on time at this portion of the of what's happening here. I'm going to introduce you to a few people, and I'm going to tell you what's happening downstairs. And Betty's going to also introduce the board. Betty didn't tell you that she's the president of the board of directors here. She just said her name, but she's been a remarkable leader here. We're so lucky to have her. So let me first introduce, well, Aaliyah and Claire you've met, but there are a couple other people who work here. Marka Doherty, who's sitting right here, works with us, taking care of this beautiful building and the grounds. Really quite an astonishing job to keep this place beautiful. And Pam Wickham is our intern from Leslie for the year. No, the year. I want her for the year, for the semester. So we're really glad that you're here. And Jeb was not able to be here today, resident. So the other people I want to just have stand up are, there is a very small group of amazing people who are your 30th anniversary committee, who've been meeting every week or two to pull together not only this event, but the upcoming events, along with the help of many volunteers who are not on the committee. But I want to just let you know who these people are, because they've had, they're visionaries and they're working really hard to make this an incredible year. So stand up, please. Rochelle Weichman is one of them. Betty Burks, Navalette DiMercato, and Terry Cooley.